Well, let's see. Yeah, there it is. Good to see everyone this evening. Glad you are here. And I trust that we will have a study that will be beneficial to each and every one of us. The Bible states in 1 Timothy 4 and verse 10 that our God is a living God. At times, God, though, seems to be or does not seem to be a real part of this world because we can't see him, can't reach out and touch him. There's no designated place we can go to and say, there's God. And at times, God seems like a stranger. But how can we better realize that God plays a major role in this world in which we live and in our own daily lives? How can we know that God is alive? Well, one thing is that we can see God's hand in creation. How often do you look at or admire the creation and forget about who created it? I mean, we look at flowers and we look at scenes and things and we think, aren't those beautiful? How often do you think about who created it? The first obvious step in seeing God as alive and well is seeing the creation as the work of God. I know that my grandsons have mentioned how they remember whenever they would go out with me and we would go fishing or something, and I would say, just look at all that God's created. Isn't it beautiful? And that's something they remember to this day. But, you know, not only did God create this, but we must realize that its continued existence depends on God. It's easy to believe that God created everything, but that was a long time ago. We need to remember that God still controls the world in which we live. Just consider the sun. Jesus is recorded as saying in Matthew 5:44 that you may be sons of your Father in heaven, for he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. Isn't it wonderful to see a beautiful sunset or a beautiful sunrise? But next time you do, be conscious of the fact that the sun belongs to God, and it continues to exist because of God. I say that because man seems to think that he's got some kind of a corner on the market because he can fly things up to where the sun is and bring them back again. And so what? So what? He didn't put that sun out there. But another thing that we see God in is the ever-changing seasons. Despite what some doomsday thinkers are saying, God has said in his word in Genesis 8 and verse 22, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, day and night shall not cease. This, dear ones, is a promise from God. The very idea that man is going to somehow destroy the sun out of the sky, and that's poppycock. No way that's going to happen. God said these things are going to continue until there is no more time. Speaking of God, Paul said to the crowd in Lystra in Acts 14 and verse 17 that God did not leave himself without witness. Now notice, in that he did good, he gave us rain from heaven, fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. I don't know about you, but I'm pretty sure that I am not alone in saying that I look forward to the change of seasons, especially whenever spring is here. And then after spring is here, I can't wait till summer, and summer's gone and so forth. But next time we say this, let's remember that summer is here because of God's promise and his existence. Each season as it comes is a continual reminder to man of God's ongoing care for this earth and this universe. Consider carefully now what Paul said there in Acts 14, 17. He did not leave himself without witness. You know, I looked back at that and I said, what does that mean? And so I looked up the word witness. And the word actually means unattested. It is defined by plainly revealed in his works. That's Arnton Gingrich, Greek to English lexicon. Well, what does this mean? God continues to give plenty of demonstrations of his existence. That's what it means. He did good, gave us rain from heaven, fruitful seasons. Well, fruitful seasons depend on rain from heaven. Do we forget that our food supply depends on God's existence? No rain, no food. Oh, but we shop at the grocery store. Well, does that mean that we don't need God? We got the grocery store? No. The grocery store buys their food from a farmer who depends on rain. And that's all coming from God. It is a part of the evidence that God is actively doing good in this world. And that indeed we have few, if any, unfruitful seasons. The result of God's reigns is filling our hearts with food and gladness. You know, filling comes from a Greek word that means to fill up or to satisfy, either literally or figuratively. And the word gladness is from a word that means joyfulness. The happiness and joy of the people that Paul was talking to came from plenty that God gave them. How much of our daily happiness is due to God? Think about this. Now, I know that one family here at least, and I say at least because I don't know about all of you, but one family I know of has a garden. Oh, yeah. Beautiful. I saw it on Facebook. It's got to be real if I saw it on Facebook. So anyway, and now how much happiness do you get from doing this? I remember when I was a boy child, way back when, and we would plant a garden. Oh, we'd prepare the ground, and we would put our rows of radishes. Radishes didn't have much luck, because as soon as they got to where there's a little red top on them, they got eaten. I don't know about what that boy was thinking about. But anyway, but we grew all lettuce, and we corn, And that just filled our heart with gladness. But what about a good meal? A meal of good food. Just as an example, steaks. I know somebody said they're going to cook steaks. How do you feel about that? Is it just a steak is a steak? Does that really fill your heart with gladness? Or let's take it from a different point of view. How do you feel on a beautiful day like today? Beautiful, beautiful weather. And what does the ocean do for your spirits? I tell you, I just love hearing the ocean rolling in. How many times is our present happiness linked directly to God's blessings in this earth? But we also consider the universe. Paul wrote in Colossians 1:17, "And he is before all things, and in him all things consist." Now, here Paul is speaking of Christ, through whom all things have been created. Do I have that? Yeah, there we are. I want to put that up there so you can see it. Colossians 1, verse 16. But again, not only did God create it, visible or invisible, but in him all, notice the all things consist. All things here refers to all created things. And the word consist means to set together. Now, let's think about this. To set together. What does that mean? Well, another lexicographer defines this as to stand with or fall together, to be constituted, to be compact. By him, literally, by him, all things stand together, coming from W.E. Vine's Expository Dictionary. Well, we go over to Arnton Gingrich and we find to continue, endure, exist, to hold together. Looking just a little further here, we have the definition, hold together, cohere. He has a principle of cohesion. Well, what does this statement here mean? Significant theologically is the statement in Colossians 1:17, which we just saw, that Christ is before all things and all things consist or have their existence in him. That's about as plain as you can put it, isn't it? God continues to hold the universe together. In other words, if God were not alive, and if God were not active, the universe would disintegrate. Well, that's interesting. But in what else can we see this? Well, I believe that we can see that God is alive when we see him in the political realm. You know, do you look without any concern at world events? I think it can become an obsession. But what importance and what meaning do we attach to the upheavals of the nations of the world? I mean, when you look at the political situation and world events, you can't help but think about Psalm 47 and 8. Listen to it carefully. God reigns over the nations. God sits on his holy throne. If you claim to believe the Bible, then you better believe that. That's a fact. And Jeremiah chapter 27, verses 5 and 6. God speaking here, I have made the earth, the man and the beast that are on the ground, and my great power and my outstretched arm have given it to whom it seemed proper to me. And now I have given these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant. And the beasts of the field I have also given to him to serve him. No one else could say that. No one else could say that. Only God. And in Daniel chapter 2 and verse 21, speaking of God, he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. On down to Daniel 4:17. This decision is by the decree of the watchers, and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. No nation or people are ever exempt from serving the true and living God. Even the world's rulers are responsible to God, whether they like it or not. Just look at the way that God referred to Jeremiah and Nebuchadnezzar in Jeremiah 27:5, my servant. Now, if you read about Nebuchadnezzar, you go, whoa. Yeah, but that's the way God chose him to do a particular job. Paul wrote in Romans chapter 13. Now, you can say what you want to. Oh, that's Old Testament. That's back in the Old Testament. Okay. Romans chapter 13, beginning with verse 1. Okay? Listen carefully. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. You want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid. for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Therefore, you must be subject, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this you pay taxes, for they are God's ministers, attending continually to this very thing. Therefore, render to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Now, what do you say? Sounds like God's still in control. Just as easily as God created the earth with all of its life, he can give dominion to whom he will. And note this, he can take it away too. Just as he did from Nebuchadnezzar. Too often as we study the Old Testament, we may think of God as only dealing with the Jews. But the truth is that God was active in world powers of the day. Now, how should we look at world events today? Does history take on new meaning? Do we see importance in elections? You know, how many times do we feel powerless in the voting process? You know, a lot of people have just quit voting. They're going to do it anyway. You know, nobody counts votes. Well, that's what the devil's counting on. He's counting on enough good people not doing anything where he can get his way. And he can control it. Oh, it may not go your way. I'll tell you, whenever we vote on propositions, I always find myself being in the minority for how I vote for them. Because I'm pretty much opposed to anything going to cost me more money. But, you know, that's all right. I still had a voice. And I was heard regardless. But we need to see elections as being important. As Christians, we have power. But it may not be evident right then, or even immediately, but we have power. We know that the God that they serve rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomever he will. And God will become alive to us when we realize his hand is in all human governments, whether they rise or whether they fall. We may not be able to understand it. We may not be able to figure it out, but it always has been. And Romans 13 certainly places it in the same category for us today. Did I say Romans 14? Romans 13. Yeah, okay. Just checking. I was going to run the tape back, but it'd take too much time. We're also impressed with the fact that God can use us. Look at Daniel 4:17, if you would, please. The Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomever he will and sets over it the lowest of men. Now, in this context, we're not talking about sleazeballs or unsavory characters, if you will. We're talking about humble men, low men. God can be more alive whenever we realize that God can use anyone, no matter how unimportant, how humble, how poor, how common. How many times do you find yourself suffering from an inferiority complex? Thinking, well, what could I do? Do you know that keeps us from doing anything? God is the one who gives us the power to do anything. In Deuteronomy 8 and verse 18, the text says, "You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is He who gives you power to get wealth, that He may establish His covenant, which He swore to your fathers, as it is this day." 1 Chronicles 29 and verse 12, both riches and honor come from God, and God reigns over all. In God's hand is power and might, and in God's hand it is to make great and to give strength to all. Now, I've supplemented that, the pronoun, with the noun to make it clear. I'm sure yours read differently. But to the church at Philadelphia, Jesus wrote in Revelation 3 and 8, "I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it. You have a little strength, have kept my word, and have not denied my name." The open door provided by God is a door that is opened and no man shuts it. It is our little strength that is enhanced when the door is open. We cannot stand by and say, "Oh, God will get it done. All depends on Him." No, no, no. But neither can we proudly say, "We did it all ourselves." No, that's not it either. One has commented on this passage in Revelation and stated, whether its power was small because of its few members or because of its economic status in comparison to others, wealthier groups in the city, or because of lowly social order out of which its members have been called, its power was sufficient enough to achieve God's purpose. Consider all the small people that God's used. The apostles were just lowly men. They were just men who were unlearned. Gideon was from a poor family, and in fact, least in the house of his family. Jephthah was the son of a harlot. David was the youngest in his family. But we have to realize that God can do great things through us. And it doesn't take completely depending on our own strength to do that. Well, that brings a question to my mind. Who knows what God is doing? Well, that's a good question. How many times do we reason this way? Well, God is actively working, but just how and for what purpose? I'll just watch and wait and see how things work out. This is what some of people did, kept from working. In 1 Samuel 4 and verse 6, Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. It may be, perhaps, not sure, but willing to see. And surely, we know from this case, that God was with them. And they went up against the Philistines. Likewise, in 2 Samuel 12 and 22, we find the words of David recorded concerning his son born by Bathsheba, when he said, "While the child was still alive, I fasted and wept. For I said, who can tell whether the Lord will be gracious to me that the child may live?" David wasn't sure, but he was willing to continue fasting and praying to see if perhaps the Lord would spare his son. How many of us have been in similar situations with the illness of a loved one? How did we handle our uncertainty? Did we say, "Oh, it's no use. I don't know what God's will is here. I can't act one way or another." Surely, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego could not be certain what would happen to them. Notice in Daniel 3, beginning with verse 16, they said, "Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able," notice now, "is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you set up." Boy, it takes a lot of strength. But they did it. They knew that God was able. And even if he didn't do it, they were not going to submit to the golden idol, period. How many of God's heroes were not entirely sure what God's will would be in a particular situation? But did that handcuff them? Did it make them do nothing? No. Consider Paul in Acts 18. Acts 18, verses 9 and 10. Paul, Lord spoke to Paul in the night by a vision. "Do not be afraid, but speak, and do not keep silent. For I am with you, and no one will attack you to hurt you. For I have many people in this city." Now, God promised to be with him. Yet, verse 12 says that the people dragged him to the judgment seat and accused him. Now, think about that. Had something gone wrong? Well, in Acts 18, verses 14 and 15, Paul was about to open his mouth when Gallio, the proconsul, said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of wrongdoing or wicked crimes, O Jews, there would be a reason why I should bear with you. But if it's a question of words and names and your own law, look to it yourselves, for I do not want to be a judge in such matters." God protected Paul from harm by having the proconsul of Achaia, being a man that wanted to have nothing to do with debates about religious matters, Paul did not have any reason to worry. He could have said, "Well, I'm not sure how God's going to do this. This isn't looking good." But he went right on ahead. And he acted. And he did what he was expected to do. Now, how do you look at life? Do you look at the things that happen in this life as inconveniences or opportunities? Paul wrote in Colossians 4 and 5, walk in wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time. We're to use wisdom. That's what we're studying about in the book of Proverbs. Use wisdom in our dealings with those who are not members of the body of Christ and use our time wisely. Just for an example, how do you view people that you come in contact with in the business world? Is it just an inconvenience you have to put up with? Huh? Is it just an inconvenience? Or is it, oh, here's someone I can talk to about their soul? What about people that want to give you literature? You don't have to go very many places. You find someone trying to do that. Do you have literature ready to give them? Do you have some tracts by your door or in your purse or in the car? Next time, ask yourself this question. Why has this person crossed my path? Could it be my opportunity to save them? We need to think about these things. And remember that God can use bad and good situations. Just because a situation's bad doesn't mean God can't use it. Remember Joseph and his brothers? I don't think I have to tell you about them. His brothers meant evil against him. Most of them wanted to kill him. And at best, that's what some of them thought they had done, selling him into slavery. But he says to his brothers, as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about as it is this day, to save many people alive. What happened to him was bad, but God used it for good. Perhaps economic hardships, which seem bad, are useful to teach us to use wealth wisely. Look how Paul viewed his imprisonment in Philippians chapter 1 and verse 12. He said, I want you to know, brethren, the things which happened to me have actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel. What? Not all the bad things that happened to Paul were without good. We need to look for good to be accomplished. And sometimes that means we have to have our eyesight on that which is good and not all the bad stuff. We need to also recognize the fragile nature of our lives. I believe that this will help us to see that God is alive. You know, speaking to the people about the unknown God in Acts 17:25, Paul told the Athenians that God gives life, breath, and all things. Then down verse 28, he went on to say, in him we live and move and have our being. Our lives are linked with him. Our lives are linked. We utterly depend on him for breath, food, and physical blessings. For this reason, we must have the proper attitude in our daily planning. And where is that found? Oh, yeah, in James 4 and verse 15. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. And there's a couple of examples of it right there where Paul did it. God will seem more alive to us when we realize that He can overrule all our well-laid plans, that we are not in charge even of our own futures here on earth. The future holds surprises, things not anticipated, and we cannot plan for everything, or let me say, can't even plan for most things. Also, and I think this is one of the key points that you need to take away from this lesson, we need to have a pilgrim mentality. Now, what do I mean by this? Well, in Hebrews 11 and verse 13, the writer says, these all died in faith. All these are characters of faith in the New Testament and Old Testament. Not having received the promises, and having seen them afar off, and were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed, listen, that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. That's the mentality we need to have. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, beginning verse 16, Paul says, therefore, we do not lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. The things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. The fact that God is alive is even more evident if we are truly, and I mean truly, people of the book. You know, when I was growing up, members of the Church of Christ were pretty well marked by the door-to-door people, the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses, whatever they are, as people of the book. You don't want to tangle with these people. But I don't feel that's the case anymore. I don't feel that there's any fear in them, because most of the ones who claim to be members of the Lord's church are not people of the book. They don't know how to test everything. They don't know how to hold fast to that which is good. Why? Because their mind is not constantly in the book. They are not always thinking God's thoughts. People of the book are people who use God's word as their guide in their daily lives. The ultimate reality that God is alive is the fact that all souls belong to Him. Ezekiel 18 and 14. What does that mean? What does that mean? Well, the rest of that verse is, the soul of the Father and the soul of the Son is mine, and the soul who sins will die. The ultimate reality is that all souls must give an account to God. Romans 14. All As I live, says the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall confess to God. So then each one shall give an account of himself to God. God becomes very much alive when we consider anything we say or do in this life by asking ourselves, do I feel comfortable in answering God for this area of my life? Before we act or say or put off, we need to ask ourselves, am I ready to answer to God for this? Now, I want you to understand, our God is alive, but that's not just for elders, not just for teachers, not just for preachers, but all people, all members. Why? Because we're all responsible to God. That's why. Every one of us will give an account someday to God for the way we have lived. Are we ready? Are we prepared to give an answer to God? We have an opportunity now to come and ask for prayers on behalf of ourselves, for sins that we may have committed or for problems in our life. We pray for each other because we care about each other. And if you are here in need of the prayers of the brethren, we invite you to come now while we stand and while we sing.